you probably don't have a ton of infrastructure. And the idea that you need a credit card to establish credit is, you know, on its face, just absurd. Not only can you not get a credit card, but there's no bank.
This is Humane, a weekly podcast focused on bridging the gap between humans and machines in this age of acceleration. My name is David Jacobovich, and on this podcast, I interview experts in sociology, psychology, artificial intelligence, researchers on consumer-facing products, and consumer-facing companies to help audiences better understand AI and its many capabilities. If you like the show, remember to subscribe and leave a review.
Hey listeners, this is David Jacobovich from the Humane Podcast. We live in challenging times with complex financial markets. Lex Sokolin joins us from the UK to share how you can be a part of the new economy. How can you make investment decisions driven around machine and human economies? How real is the debate around privacy across America, Europe, and China? Is capitalism dead as we know it? Learn all this and more on today's episode of Humane. Tune in now.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Humane Podcast, where we're discussing how to bridge the gap between humans and machines in the fourth industrial revolution. Today, our guest is Lex Sokolin, who is an expert in financial entrepreneurship, advisory, robo-advisors, taking decentralization into the new economy, and is joining us from the United Kingdom. Thanks for being here, Lex.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's, you know, 2019 and we're halfway into it almost, it feels, and there's so many new projects happening and you've been a part of a lot of tech. What are you seeing as some of the new trends going on in your industries?
I mean, isn't it amazing that it is 2019? It just sounds so futuristic to be in this year. I feel like if you look at most of the 1980s action movies, by 2019, you know, the world's either destroyed or we're levitating. So maybe it kind of sucks that, you know, we haven't gotten there. But we do have a lot of artificial intelligence in our economy already. Everything from, you know, the very first time you touch the internet through Google to, you know, putting a filter on like a Snapchat interface, all the way through to interacting with like financial products broadly. So banking, investing, lending, insurance, all of that stuff that used to be intermediated by human beings, massively targeted by artificial intelligence companies now. So, you know, happy to open that up, but I'm seeing symptoms for AI in finance everywhere from the consumer to, you know, the portfolio manager.
There's a lot of great products that I think consumers can look at in finance, as you mentioned. Here in the United States, you know, some of these big products are Robinhood with the trading and automation. You have Chime, this new, you know, online bank to have these interest rates. And then you even have apps, as you mentioned, maybe in that robo space where you invest so many dollars a month and it, you know, creates a self-directed portfolio. I think the financial markets are very quickly decentralizing and very quickly becoming an app economy. You've been a part of, you know, quite a bit of this. What do you find most fascinating about the change of wealth with all this technology?
Yeah, so I think, you know, technology is it's an interesting catch-all because really it's a word that reflects the tools that we as human beings have to be effective. And when we use sticks and fire, we use technology. When we invent languages, we have technology. When we do physics and math, that's technology. So, you know, in the last decade, what we've really seen is the digitization of all the industries, from media to retail to now finance and healthcare, and more broadly to like the core of society as a whole. So, you know, symptoms of the latter would be, you know, propaganda bots being able to influence elections. That is technology used for kind of a civic purpose. But in finance, you've had about 20 years of automation, and the automation is shifting from kind of top-down defined automation. So like you used to fill out a piece of paper for opening an account, and now you can key some things into your phone, or you can take a picture of your passport to open an account. And that is really straightforward, rules-based, deterministic kind of replacement of a workflow with a couple of data points by a software version of the same thing. The other version of automation, which is more threatening and more meaningful and kind of fundamental, is machine learning on top of large data sets. And you know, it's obviously super buzzy, and people say these things and don't really mean anything when they say it. But realistically, this is the truth, where all the services that used to be physical and terrestrial now have digital chassis that create data exhaust. So, you know, anytime we go on a site, that's captured. Anytime we sign anything, that's captured. How we move our mouse on a robo-advisor site is captured. You know, how we put in credit card information, the speed between the keystrokes is captured. So all that data exhaust can then be used to power decision-making. And you can get thousands and thousands of data points for credit decisions, lending decisions, insurance decisions, investment decisions that you never just would have had in the past. So when I look at, you know, some of the folks that you mentioned, I think those companies are definitely innovating on the way that clients interact with financial products. It's like having it in your pocket is definitely cool and interesting and fast. But the next step after that is using new types of this data exhaust to take human judgment and, you know, remove the human from it and have it run kind of on autopilot. And that does a lot of things that are unanticipated. The very first thing is it just makes it way cheaper to manufacture a financial product. And that's, you know, that's the second step to making it more accessible. So it's not just that you can get a bank account at a regular bank easier. It's that it can be done on the fly on your phone by a thin algorithm that just knows a little bit about you. And then, you know, not to go totally to the moon, but you can split the stuff out in the next step of, well, if you're doing it in such a lightweight manner, maybe you can posit it on a decentralized network, and then you can have communities in a real peer-to-peer fashion fulfill some of the promise of what the early internet pioneers had imagined.
And, you know, translating that for the consumers, I think we're moving in that direction, right? So today we're seeing all these digital apps where your data exhaust has allowed you to have these apps in your phone, your mobile device. You've been able to use new technologies at the banks, at your workplace, and where you live. But the consumer hasn't necessarily benefited that much from using them, other than having an easier, accessible way to use these apps. So then the question is, what's next, and how do consumers take back their rights, or take back their privacy, or take back their wealth? And it sounds like some of the work you're doing in, you know, the decentralized space could lead to that. And wanted to hear your thought leadership there.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, that first step, I think the Chinese examples are really mind-bending, especially for Americans who are so used to the segregation between media, technology, and finance. You know, so let's say you are living in a rural community. There is no bank or bank branch. You probably don't have a ton of infrastructure. And the idea that you need a credit card to establish credit is, you know, on its face, just absurd. Not only can you not get a credit card, but there's no bank. And if there were a bank, there's no information based on which they could make a decision. So instead, you get a mobile app on your phone, because phones are more distributed than banking services. And that mobile app is supposedly a private company that lets you message and buy stuff on the mobile web, but realistically is a government app that tracks all your interactions. And it tracks your shopping behavior, it tracks your messaging behavior, it tracks whether you play video games or if you're studying, it tracks your health, it tracks your grades if you're in school. And so this kind of third-party information in WeChat or for Ant Financial, that's actually used to underwrite your credit decision. Like, what's a credit decision? Well, let's say you're a kid from this rural community and you go to university, you're accepted. Well, you don't have any money, so you can't buy any books. So you go to the bookstore to buy your textbooks. How do you buy your textbooks? You buy them on credit. How is that credit decision made? Well, you scan your messaging app, and the messaging app knows if you've been, naughty or nice, and that's called the social credit score. So that's an example, and all this stuff, right, is machine learning based. So, 800 million or so users in China power the engine for the algorithmic decision making there. So that's an example of something like a financial product, like a credit product, being made available on the data exhaust that, an American bank would literally have no idea and honestly failed to do anything with when the US had the lead on this technology 10 years ago. So that's point number one. Point number two is the sort of decentralization direction. So of course, the last 3 years have been challenging in many ways, and one of them has been just kind of the realization of the price that we paid for free services, right? So it's 2002, and it's cool to pirate music, and you get it all on your iPhone, and it's great. But you look at the music labels who are saying, buy CDs, and you think of them as dinosaurs. And so we've had a generation, including myself, trained on this idea that the internet is free. And of course, it's not free. It's just that you're paying a price you don't know about. And now we figured out what that price is. And that price is that essentially we don't get to make our own decisions. We get to be educated by machines about, how we should... what we should purchase, i.e. advertising, who we should vote for, and so on and so forth. So that's a high price because now that we know it, so we want to kind of address it. But to address it, you really need to shift this model of consume for free and become the product. And so I see a lot of solutions coming out of the decentralization space where whether it's your data or whether it's your money or whether it's this sort of tracking of your behavior or if it's medical information, all of that stuff goes back into your power through some version of tokenization and communities. It's very interesting to watch. It's also really difficult to implement, and I think people got burnt quite a lot by it. But whether Facebook does it or whether some crypto project does it, almost besides the point, because the general direction is that I think people will have on their own phones, on their hardware, on their computers, much more control over this data and whether they opted into the services or not.
And so whether we call it the crypto or blockchain movement, it sounds like from your examples on China with, WeChat and Ant Financial and this social credit system, that there's, to me, two directions society's moving. It's either moving a social credit system or a capitalistic system. And that's often how, Europe and America have defined themselves versus the Eastern Asian countries. So, I'm curious if products that you're beginning to talk about, JP Morgan's coming out with a coin, Facebook's coming out with a coin, are these products that could work theoretically in China?
Yeah, so it's a great point and area of discussion because it's so tricky. A few symptoms to think about. The first is the space race, the initial space race, funded by the government, by sovereign powers in the Soviet Union and in the US. The internet, funded by the government. It's a military network, right? So it's not the rule that all consumer apps come from the private sector. You know, it's been the trend in 30 or 40 years of Silicon Valley, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the absolute rule. And so we can definitely imagine a world, right, where the massive government investment in China in artificial intelligence and blockchain and various frontier technologies, that is successful, you know, because that you deal with the fixed cost of research and development by this massive government spending. And so I think the U.S. is fairly disadvantaged there because having an aggressive R&D policy doesn't seem to be really what the U.S. is about these days. Number two, a second point is that actually I think there's a lot more similarity between capitalism and dictatorship than maybe comes at first glance, right? So you kind of have this view of capitalism as lots and lots of firms competing with products and the best wins, and you know these are entrepreneurs and it's flexible and all that. In reality, what happens after a while is that you, especially in monopolizable industries like attention, right, Google and Facebook, or finance, Visa, MasterCard, JP Morgan, you have really asymmetrical markets where, you know, most of the winnings are controlled by very few players. This is true for professional athletes, right? A couple of professional athletes make $100 million and the rest are fine, but they don't make that money. There's only one Justin Bieber, right? Like this is the power laws happen over and over and over again. So capitalism allows for sort of that selection mechanism to occur, but then at the end of it, you're left with these monoliths. And if you've ever worked on Wall Street, and I have, what you find is that they are run like hierarchical, you know, Soviet Union style organizations. So if you are on a strategy team in a, you know, what you would think of as a very capitalist investment bank institution, in fact, what you're doing is putting together 5-year strategy plans and financial models with targets for your staff to hit. That is, you know, both China and the Soviet Union had a lot of 5-year plans to hit targets. So the management style within the large organizations, very, very similar. You know, so when I think about like JPM or Facebook trying to go build a product, and when I think about China as a whole trying to build a product, I do think of both as very top-down processes. And it's tough for me to imagine sort of an American monopoly or oligopoly competing very successfully within the Chinese borders. I think it's essentially we're locked out from that geography. But the other direction is this more like open source, decentralized direction, which is less profit driven and more maybe humanistic. It's certainly more idealistic. And I'm not espousing the philosophy of the crypto ecosystem. I don't want to kind of celebrate that approach, but I do think there's a truth to what sharing and open source systems can do and how they can leak around large and powerful organizations in the way that media and Twitter could leak around, Turkey and Egypt and their controls on information, in the same way that the tech companies are kind of getting into finance by leaking around and building things at the extremes. I think that an open source, decentralized version of these products, whether they're finance or entertainment or any other version of it, they can be shared much more easily, and they do have censorship resistance. And I do think that's new and interesting. And as kind of a final point in that story, you know, people are running Android software on their Google phones. That's not correct. They're running Android on all sorts of manufactured phones, and Android is, you know, the most popular operating system in the world, and of course it's an open source operating system. So I think there are examples where these open solutions win and succeed, but I don't think that there's a very good sense right now for how the decentralized movement will actually do that.
I get a sense from what you're sharing, and as an aha moment for me, is that we're very much moving to a zero marginal cost society. In fact, you know, in 2015, Jeremy Rifkin came out with a book by that name, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, about how products in this digital age no longer cost so much to print and so much to deliver, because you produce the product once and that cost is finite, and then it can scale across and be distributed to all users. And it sounds like whether we're looking at new financial robo-advisory products or products that are powered by your social capital, these are all distributed. These have very low marginal cost, and this is a direction that we're moving towards. And I don't think it's just a game of the United States versus the European Union, ex-EU, or China, but society as a whole. And from a macro level, I think, like, if I'm someone who's a blue collar worker, I'm trying to think what's next, right? How can I manage my capital when America and Europe are at negative growth or zero growth? And, you know, China's on the brink of a recession, you know, just in the first few months of 2019, they've injected over $300 billion of capital into their economy as well. So I think the modes of finance are beginning to change.
Sure. There's definitely, you know, there's a couple of stories I tell around this. One is, across all financial services, we should expect pricing to collapse 50%. That's driven by lower cost manufacturing and lower cost distribution. And it's happened to every other industry already, you know, starting with music and to retail and up. And so investment management costs a quarter of a percent rather than 1.5%. Moving money costs a tenth of a percent instead of 6% internationally, right, TransferWise. And insurance costs similarly down. You know, you pay for insurance when you drive your car, not because you have a car. So all these things are for sure pulling apart these product-first companies and reconstituting them at a much lower price point. And it's rotating the industry from product-first to customer-first. And that's, you know, it's not an original insight, but it is 90 degrees from what finance is used to doing, right? Like, I don't really care that some company manufactures a bank account. What I care is that when I'm an Amazon, I can invoke that bank account in order to buy something. But I'm doing 2,000 other things at Amazon. So my interest in the bank account is nominal. It's very small. And so the sort of arrogance of the industry about how important the manufacturing is something that's just going to be challenged with economics degrading over the next decade or two. So I think that's that shift from pushing product to being pulled by a consumer is definitely quite painful to the industry. Now, whether that means the elimination of jobs, how to think about the balance between the elimination of cost and potentially the elimination of lower skilled jobs versus the gains to the consumer from being able to access the stuff cheaper, on demand, more easily, is definitely, the jury's still out. You know, and the thing about automation and finance is that the jobs that are threatened are not just the folks in the branch or that are doing the financial advice or selling insurance. They're also the sort of the mid-skilled and the higher-skilled jobs just as much, absolutely just as much. And you look at the lawyers who, you know, will charge you $1,500 an hour. Those guys are in trouble too, because I can get an AI to read 10,000 documents in the same time that one lawyer reads one document. So all of this stuff is going to be seeing massive bites taken out of the value chain. Generally speaking, as like an observation on what people do with their time, that's a very good thing. You know, as a throwback, in the 1940s, a computer used to be a human being that sat in a room of 40 other people doing math, right? So those 40 people are no longer computers. They've lost that job. So you could say that's, you know, that's progress. So the question is, how do you solve for the real damage it does to people's livelihoods? And how do you solve for, and who has to solve for it? Like, whose job is it to make sure that the people that are inevitably going to be fired have a healthy, interesting, fulfilling human existence? And I think we in the US, we're so confused about the responsibilities and where they fall. You know, like, why is it, I will never understand why it's the role of your employer, the company you work for, why do they provide you your healthcare coverage? Why is your, you know, why is your capitalist employer paying for the healthcare of the employees? Why is your capitalist employer, you know, maintaining your retirement? Like, if I'm a startup and I've got two people and I barely raised any money, I can't really pay for anybody's healthcare or for anybody's retirement or any of the benefits. So, you know, it's a really arbitrary place to put taking care of people. But it's kind of the cultural outcome of the US to, and for lots of structural reasons, that's where it sits. So, you know, I think we have to have a public debate about, does the government deal with the structural damage? Do the large employers deal with the structural damage? What about the small employers? They can't afford to do it in many cases. You know, it's a little bit depressing to look at the state of our politics and be like, how are we going to deal with what is a spectacularly large existential question for all of humanity when, you know, we can't stop tweeting at each other?
You know, the healthcare debate is a very fascinating one, especially for those in the United States. And I've actually read up a lot on this and debated this with some colleagues. And it's actually a result of teacher unions. It's a result of post-World War I. It's the result of hospitals getting together back in the 1920s and 1930s, wanting to provide these benefits for a very small population. But then what happened was this bandwagon effect of everyone saying, now we need to provide healthcare benefits. And, you know, fast forward into the 2000s, it's state of the art. It's normal. If you don't offer healthcare benefits, sorry, I'm not interested in your company.
Yeah. And know. I mean, this, you know, end of the day, it's nonsense. It's a bad game theory equilibrium where in the prisoner's dilemma, you can't, you know, neither party can change its position because they'd be worse off. But they are both worse off in the situation where they are relative to what if they both moved over, right? So the employer has no skill or interest in optimizing healthcare costs. And to put employees in a position where they, you know, they can't take a risk, they can't start up a company because their family is now not covered, is also nonsense. Like, if you want to encourage the most innovation and risk taking by your population, and you want to encourage sort of venture capitalism in that way, like, of course, being tied, getting the best healthcare from JP Morgan should not be the incentive that somebody in the technology group there has to think about. So it's total nonsense. You know, I think there are better collective places to put healthcare than on the shoulders of for-profit businesses. So when you start touching things like, you know, structural unemployment, which could be the result of AI in the, you know, in the trucking industries shortly, with things that Uber and Lyft are doing in the taxi industries, and increasingly in the services as those become more automatable. Structural unemployment is a collective social issue that needs to be dealt with from a policy perspective by people who understand how the world looks like in 2040. And I think we have a lot of information about what the world looks like in 2040 because we see what is being put together as the infrastructure for that moment. So, you know, hopefully that only clarifies over time. And I think private voices like Bezos and Musk and Zuckerberg, who, despite all the other stuff that, you know, you can fault them for, who at least articulated some of the dangers around rushing into this and just, you know, slamming the car against a wall and not preparing for it. So maybe that's one way forward.
And, you know, we're still hearing these voices from, as you mentioned, a lot of Silicon Valley heavyweights. And this year, when a lot of companies IPO, there'll be a lot of millennial tech workers who will become instant millionaires. The Wall Street Journal and New York Times said this year there's going to be over 10,000 new millionaires in the United States once all these companies go public. And you think from a capitalist standpoint, what does that do to society? Does it raise rents? Do people need benefits any longer? And do they need those benefits in the first place from a healthcare perspective? I think the themes of structural automation, if we're going down that pathway, is there's many different parts of the industry that looks at. I know with your work at Autonomous and Autonomous Next, you talk about the crypto economy, artificial intelligence, robo-advisors, and many other fringe themes as well. And automation is going to affect everywhere, but how can people best prepare to be a part of that? I want to launch a startup that I'm going to automate rather than I'm disincentivized to launch a startup because I'm locked into my employer healthcare plan that I can't leave the company or I need this benefit. And I think a lot of that is also perception versus reality. I think most people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s don't really need the health insurance as it's sold in America. I think it's a little bit overhyped and overpromised. I think more the direction we should consider moving is as you've mentioned, Lex, this decentralized direction where accessibility is offered everywhere. One recent story I read in the news a couple weeks ago, I wouldn't have read about it if it wasn't as a result of a scandal. So the scandal was the head of the Food and Drug Administration in the United States stepped down and resigned, but not much was shared about why this occurred. And I decided to look further into this and found out that in the last 15 years, there's been all these FDA-approved medical devices being used in hospitals like balloons when you're expanding a stomach for surgery and other devices to hold up organs that have been malfunctioning. There have been staplers used to serve as reattaching tissue that gets stuck when they're being used. And it's mind-blowing to think, why would the stapler just get stuck and then cause a life-threatening issue? But the thing is, these examples I'm sharing here have been hidden from the public. They're not accessible. It's locked away behind lawsuits and documents and by privilege of the government. So I think my hope and love to hear some of your insights there, given you know, your experience in both business and legal. You know, what's a better path forward and where are you seeing some of that direction?
So a lot of ideas there. I think what's a good place to start? So you know, in terms of the wealth being created, the trends are, you know, unassailable and not, you know, they're sort of true and boring, and the truth, they're true and boring in the sense that the population, the distribution of wealth and income are getting more unequal, and there's nothing anyone can ever do to stop it. The end. That, you know, that's just it. There is literally zero actions that will shift that. And the reason for it is that the inequality comes from really deeply rooted and unassailable structures of society, which is you can model them out in a simulation, and this is just what happens, right? So you have, let's say you have a simulation, 100 people come to some geography, they compete for resources at the end of the end, they all have equal stature in the beginning because of a random distribution of events. At the end, some people have a high, you know, higher distribution of outcomes, some people have lower distribution of outcomes. Great. Next generation, right? You run, again, people of equal ability, but with different sets of resources, such as owning a $1 million home in Palo Alto, or going, you know, being prepared for school by going the private route and having SAT prep versus somebody who doesn't have access to that and comes from a broken home, right? You rerun that simulation, and then you're going to have the 20-80 rule repeat again. And so you'll have inequality in the next generation being increased. And you do that over and over and over again. And over time, what you end up with is massive inequality. And so you look at, you know, some of the old world countries where the history of wealth inequality, you know, like nobility, goes back centuries and millennia, and you're going to have, you know, embedded social castes that are very hard to move and are inflexible. The U.S. is a very young country. And so, you know, we haven't fossilized in that way yet, but it's kind of like the math of what happens when you give everyone equal opportunities, you'll have different outcomes. So there's definitely a debate around like correcting for that starting point, which I think even if you take the most extreme view about correcting for people's starting point, you're never going to go far enough to get rid of that inequality outcome. And so I think that's just something, now that it's so public, we have to find a way to live with and to make sure that everyone, at the very least, has a good, meaningful life where they're fulfilled in their craft and don't really care that Jeff Bezos, you know, like, I enjoy using Amazon. I don't begrudge Bezos his $120 billion one bit, because I can pay 10 bucks less on toilet paper. Like, it's fine. So, you know, I think there's an issue around there about coming to terms with it, about fulfilling lives, about social infrastructure, whether it's healthcare or retirement or basic income, or access to services and privacy. You know, I think there's definitely a mental health issue in there as well, because there are elements of our society that create alienation and anger, and the internet winds that stuff up as opposed to finds mentally healthy ways to deal with these things. So, you know, it's a very challenging bundle. And I think, again, these are community policy based questions that are just arising out of the internet age. And the other part about the internet age is that it accentuates inequality through these power laws, you know. So, like, I think the large tech firms, as we've seen, they just trend towards monopoly. Like, they, the bigger they get, the better they get. That's different from 50 years ago. You look at some manufacturer of cars or some, you know, somebody that makes soup. Like, the bigger they get, the less connected they get to their consumers, the more stuck they get. So some entrepreneur can come in and disrupt them because they know the customer better. Google knows the customer better than anyone, because they are bigger than anyone, and therefore they have the best returns to scale within machine learning. Like, that's a flip to the basic economics of scaling a firm. You know, bigger usually means divorced from reality, and it's not the case with tech-first firms. So that's another challenge from the internet age around how do we think about power laws, you know, and you talk about, you can talk about Teddy Roosevelt doing the trust busting in the beginning of the last century. Like, it's the beginning of this century and Liz Warren's out there wanting to bust up the internet monopolies, and whether that's the right or wrong thing is sort of, it isn't something necessarily, you know, it's, that's a hard question that's data driven, but it bears asking because the implications of allowing attention to be gathered in that way does filter all the way through. Another example of that is, I think it was Kylie Jenner just became the youngest billionaire in the fastest time. So the way she did it is she sold lipstick, you know, and like she's got 700 or 70 million followers across all her platforms. And, you know, not to disparage being super popular and selling lipstick, but like once, this is another example of returns to scale, right? Like the built-in audience of the Kardashians accumulating with interest over time, and then it becoming easier to monetize that by anyone from the clan is another example of like, it's faster than ever before and the returns are asymmetric. So, but the constructive way to look at it is, you know, this is the system that we're functioning in. There is no going back of any kind. You can't, you know, you can't make the Kardashians unpopular. You can't put Google, you can't remove the search engine. You can't uninstall everyone's apps on their phones, and you can't turn off YouTube. So here we are. And now the question is, again, how do we give the people who don't win the lottery of these games, whether they're entrepreneurship or celebrity, the people who don't win these lotteries, how do we make sure that they have a meaningful, fulfilling life where they're practicing a craft that gives them meaning, and where, you know, they're in a positive environment? And I think that is the challenge of our generation.
Lex, do you have for yourself any mental health tactics that you use to keep yourself at baseline so you're constantly reminded that you are living a meaningful and fulfilling life?
That is such a hard question, because it's a really difficult challenge, especially, you know, for entrepreneurs or people who are high performing. And so that's actually the wrong benchmark. For anybody that, you know, seeks self-improvement and compares themselves to others, which is, you know, everyone who has an Instagram account, it's really, really difficult. And it's not difficult in like you're personally failing. It's difficult in the sense of you're in a system that manufactures anxiety for you. You know, and I'll give you an example. I remember Bloomberg was still the mayor of New York, and he wanted to ban Leader of Cola, right? So you, if you watch Super Troopers, Leader of Cola is like a punchline. You shouldn't be drinking a liter of cola. It's probably bad for you. Don't do it. You know, drink some water. But if you need to drink a liter of cola, maybe like just get them in normal servings. Get like 4 cups, each one a quarter of a liter of cola. So Bloomberg, on his health kick, he was banning cigarette smoking. And he's like, you shouldn't be able to buy for $3 like a glass with a liter in it. And there was this massive pushback against Bloomberg being like, don't take away our freedom to choose whatever we want to drink. Like, if I want to eat this, I want to eat it. If I want to drink a whole liter of cola, I want to drink it. And I remember, you know, it's people who were saying this in large part were not in good health. They should not have been drinking that much cola. So the question is like, is that person, how did that person come to hold those super self-destructive beliefs? And the reason is they probably live across a Coca-Cola advertisement and see it every single day on their way to work and on their way home. And so there are billions and billions of dollars spent on forming these opinions and preference functions in consumers against any sort of unconsciously, right? Not in a way that is self-derived from first principles. And this happens to all of us all the time. We're animals. You know, this is how we're social animals. That's how we make opinions. So, you know, on the one hand, you have your personal willpower, and on the other hand, you have the 5 billion advertising budget or whatever it is of Coke. And I know which one wins, and it's not your personal willpower. And so in the same way, when you're on Instagram or Facebook, yeah, it's your personal willpower to stop scrolling and comparing, while on the other side of it is about $50 billion worth of advertising spent that goes into paying MIT PhD scientists to develop a newsfeed to break down your behavioral defenses. So I have pretty low confidence that any of us individually will be able to fight these machines. I mean, we can't. So, you know, from that perspective, it's a really hard thing to have a mechanism that allows you to feel healthy and to feel good about your community. And I, you know, I've tried different things. I've tried different practices. The place to start is self-awareness and to just call the thing out by its name, right? So like, just be truthful in describing and understanding how you're living your life and what it is that you're doing. So like, you can do the destructive thing, but at least don't tell yourself you're not. You know, that's step one. Admit you're an addict, right? And I think one practice that helps with that is journaling. So if you're writing every week and just kind of putting down your emotions, that's a way to flush your emotions out and have them be on paper and true. And you know, you don't need to share that. That's for you to think about. And then number two, for me, I have like a visual arts practice. So I do a lot of drawing and design, and that's kind of my outlet for, you know, putting the difficulties and the frustrations into, you know, into a form that's productive. And then number three, it's family and friends. Maybe that should be number one, but again, like, life is super complicated, but people are actually very, very simple. Just watch any other mammal socialize in a hierarchy. You know, so figure out a way to be surrounded by people that respect you and that can, you know, can be there emotionally, and with whom you can have a relationship based on sort of that mutual giving. And that, you know, that's just the launch pad for building more health, whether that's a yoga or a fitness practice, or whether that's, you know, gratitude or helping others. Those are like the advanced techniques that I'm still striving for. So, you know, just the basics is I think what I said, knowing what's going on, have some sort of outlet and surround yourself with people who are real.
Yeah, those are all really great tips for our audience as we're moving into this accelerated world of crypto, of AI, of automation. I mean, we could say, oh, well, you know, all those tips, just be sure to grab a liter of cola, you know, but, you know, being very serious there, it's that I think that's important, right? Whether you're having in-person interactions, remote interactions, societies only going to get more digital, only going to get more automated. And if you don't keep things in perspective, then that anxiety level keeps getting up. And in this AI forward world, everyone's always talking about the fear of missing out, the fear of machines, the machines uprising. But I think I'm very optimistic. I think humans and machines are going to work together. I think the work you're doing at Autonomous with research in fintech and crypto and many of the industries right now, I think there's a lot of hope, not just in the US and Europe, but I think globally. I think it's still a little early to tell who's going to win the race if we're going into that ethos of, you know, is it the China economy or is it the US European economy? But I think we're moving on that direction. And, you know, here at Humane, it's just having a conversation, right? Having a conversation about that direction. And I really appreciate you for being with us here today, Lex.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
That's it for this episode of Humane. I'm David Jacobovich. And if you enjoyed the show,
Don't forget to click subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you are listening to this. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you in the next one.